We left off at the end of chapter 27 of Numbers last time, and at that point God had, in the second half of chapter 27, told Moses that he was now going to be dying. Actually, this is a somewhat premature announcement because Moses did a few more things, including all the sermons in the book of Deuteronomy, before he actually did die. But this was in preparation for Moses being taken away. God told him that there was some final business to take care of, and then he was going to go. And Moses actually requested that God would appoint somebody to replace him as the leader of Israel, so they might not be like sheep without a shepherd. And so God appointed Joshua to be Moses' successor, and through a ceremony with the laying on of hands, Joshua was taken before the high priest, and Moses laid hands on him and put some of his authority upon him, as God words it in verse 20. And at that point, Joshua was recognized officially to be the next leader and successor to Moses. Now, chapters 28 and 29 go together. They are simply specific instructions about some of the sacrifices that were regularly offered. Some of the material is repeat of prior information in Leviticus. Other of it is new. Not much of it is new. Some of the details are. But in verses 1 through 8, we have again a discussion of what is usually called the continual burnt offering. The continual burnt offering was offered every morning and every night in Jerusalem eventually. Now, they weren't in Jerusalem at this time, nor were they for several hundred years after this. But wherever the tabernacle was, it was at Shiloh, then it was at Nob. Eventually, the temple was in Jerusalem. And wherever the sacrifices were offered was to be a sacrifice in the morning routinely and at night. This was called the continual burnt offering. And this was additional to any other special sacrifices that were to be offered in any other circumstances. And it basically consisted of a lamb in the morning and a lamb at night, every weekday. Now, in verses 9 and 10, it points out that on the Sabbath, this would be doubled. And this is new. Whereas there has been reference previously to the need for the continual burnt offering, we have no previous mention of the doubling of it on the Sabbath. That's in verses 9 and 10. It would be two lambs in the morning and two at night, which is an interesting thing. Jesus pointed out in Matthew chapter 12, when his disciples were criticized for picking grain on the Sabbath, he pointed out the inconsistency of his critics because of two things in the Old Testament, which he said were somewhat parallel in significance to what his disciples did. One was that David had eaten showbread, which was unlawful for anyone but the priests to eat, and therefore unlawful for David to eat, but he ate it when he was fleeing for his life, and nobody held him guilty of that. And the other example he gave is that, have you not read that on the Sabbath day the priests defile the Sabbath and are guiltless? Now, defiling the Sabbath would be, of course, by working on the Sabbath. The priests worked on the Sabbath. They did the daily, continual daily offerings. In fact, on the Sabbath, they doubled it. The workload was, in a sense, twice as heavy on the Sabbath, which is certainly the opposite direction of ceasing to work on the Sabbath. And Jesus pointed that out, too, as a justification for his disciples did. Now, Jesus anticipated that his critics would come back on that one and say, well, of course, the priests, they're doing the work of the temple. You can't have them stopping just because it's a Sabbath day. It's the temple worship. That has to go on. And in anticipation, he didn't wait for them to ask that. He anticipated and answered it. He said, and yet, in this place is one greater than the temple. Meaning that his disciples were doing his business, and he was greater than the temple. Therefore, if the temple business preempted Sabbath observance, then Jesus' business must preempt Sabbath observance, because he's greater than the temple. But he was referring to this particular law, where the continual burnt offerings were doubled. I'm not going to actually read these verses, because what I've told you is what is in them. And we could read them, but we have a number of chapters we have to cover, and some of this is repeat from earlier material. Now, another thing that is new to this passage, in addition to the doubling of their daily offerings on Sabbath in verses 9 and 10, verses 11 through 15 have something new. It says, at the beginning of your months, verse 11, you shall present a burnt offering to the Lord, two young bulls, one ram, and seven lambs of the first year without blemish, 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour as a grain offering, mixed with oil, for each bull, 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour, a grain offering, mixed with oil for the ram, and so forth. Now, this, and a kid of the goats and all that, it goes on to give some other sacrifices. These offerings were to be offered on the first day of the month. It says at the beginning of your months. Now, the Jewish months did not begin as irregularly as ours. Some of our months are 30 days, some are 31 days. We have one month that's 28 days, except on a leap year, and it's 29 days. I mean, the months are very irregular on our calendar. But the Jewish calendar was a lunar calendar. Ours are irregular because our year is based on the solar, the relationship of the sun to the earth. The earth goes around the sun one full time per year. Takes 365 1/4 days, and that's how long our year is, because we base it on the movement of the earth around the sun. The Jews based their year on the cycles of the moon. And every 30 days, the moon would go through its complete cycle of becoming, of course, there was the new moon, and eventually the full moon and all that, and the waxing and the waning of the moon. It would do its whole cycle in 30 days. And they would mark the beginning of a new month every 30 days by the new moon. Now, we don't find the term new moon used here. It just says the beginning of the months. And there is, in fact, no place in the Old Testament that speaks of this festival and this sacrifice on this particular first day of the month as the new moon. In the Old Testament, there's no reference to it. In Colossians, however, and we looked at this just the other day when we were talking about Galatians, in Colossians chapter 2, where Paul is listing some of the ceremonial laws that that were a shadow. Remember that passage, Colossians 2, verses 16 and 17? It said, these things are a shadow for the time being, but the substance, the body is of Christ. Among the things he lists as shadows, temporary things of the Jewish law, are in Colossians 2, 16, where he says, therefore let no one judge you in food or in drink, or in regard to a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths. The reason I bring this up is because I have frequently been challenged by Seventh-day Adventists and others who believe that we should keep the Sabbath, that we must keep a Saturday Sabbath. And, of course, this is one of the verses that we would use to respond to that. Well, Paul said that the Sabbaths were a shadow, and they are just as much a shadow as the food ordinances are and the festivals of the Jews and the new moons. And the Seventh-day Adventists have responded two ways to this verse. One is to say, well, the Sabbaths here don't refer to the weekly Saturday Sabbath, the Lord's Sabbath, but to special Sabbaths, either the Sabbaths that are related to the festival weeks. You'll remember that during the Passover week, the first and last day of that week were considered Sabbaths, even if they didn't fall on Saturday. Passover would begin on the 14th of the month, regardless what day of the week that was, and therefore that day would become like a Sabbath. They'd do no work in it. And likewise, the last day of that week, even if it didn't fall on a Saturday, that'd be treated as a Sabbath. And so they say, well, these Sabbaths that Paul's talking about are those special Sabbaths associated with festival weeks. And it could not mean the Lord's Sabbath, which is the seventh day of every week. That cannot be done away with because that's in the Ten Commandments, they say. Well, I say, well, the burden of proof is upon them. If Paul says Sabbaths, and he doesn't mean the only way that the Old Testament uses the term Sabbath. By the way, the term Sabbath is not used of the first and last days of the festival weeks in the Old Testament. It is true that they're told to do no work on those days and that they have a holy convocation, but the word Sabbath is not applied to them in the Old Testament. It's just a leap, an extrapolation from that those were Sabbaths, and that's what Paul's talking about. No, I think not. Paul is talking about the festivals that God ordained, including the seventh day, because he lists them in this order: festivals, new moons, and Sabbaths. Consider this. The festivals were annual or yearly. The new moons were monthly, and the Sabbaths were weekly. He's talking about all the special days of the Jewish calendar, starting with those that were the most infant and listing down to the more frequent ones. That which is annual are the festivals, the Passover, the Tabernacle, Pentecost. These festivals are annual. Then you've got the new moons. That's the first day of every month. That's monthly. Then you've got the Sabbath, which is the seventh day of every week. And that's how Paul lists them. And I don't see how anyone can make a case at all, sustain a case, that this is not talking about the seventh-day Sabbath. But a seventh-day Adventist threw me for a loop actually a few months ago, a friend of mine. And he was saying, well, where in the Old Testament does God command to keep the new moons? And what he was suggesting here is that in this verse where Paul talks about festivals, new moons, and Sabbaths, that Paul's not talking actually about Jewish ordinances, but some of the pagan festivals and the pagan ceremonies that the Colossians might be falling into. And that he is not referring to the Jewish ordinances at all. And he said he looked up in his concordance and couldn't find anywhere in the Old Testament a reference to the new moons in a passage that commanded anything about the new moon. There are references to new moons in the Old Testament, but they're not related to the festival of the new moon. And I was surprised to hear it, and I went back and did my research, and I couldn't find new moon there that used that way either. So I thought, well, I'll bet it says beginning of months, because I remembered that term from somewhere, and I got my concordance and found out that this is where it is. So there's not much on it. There's not much in the Testament about the new moons. But there doesn't happen much. If God ordained it one time, presumably it was practiced. And if it was practiced, then Paul could refer to it as a known thing. No one would wonder what he was talking about. Say, where's that verse in the Old Testament that says that? Well, if they wonder where it is, it's here. In Numbers 28:11, at the beginning of your months, there's a festival, and that was the new moon. Now, in verses 16 through 25, and then going on through the rest of that chapter and into the next, we have the individual festivals of Passover and Pentecost and trumpets and of atonement and of tabernacles. These are the major feasts. They're lined out in Leviticus chapter 23, I believe it is. And there are special offerings that are to be offered every day of these festivals. And so he tells us what those offerings are here. And that's what the rest of chapter 28 and chapter 29 are about. Verse 16, the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord. And on the 15th day of the month is the feast, which lasts a week, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Unleavened bread shall be for 7 days. On the first day, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work. Now, it talks about the special offerings they were to do daily here. And this was they were to offer a burnt offering of 2 young bulls and 1 ram and 7 lambs. Those would be burnt offerings. 2 young bulls, 1 ram, and 7 yearling lambs, a year old. And then in addition to that, they were offered to offer 1 goat as a sin offering. And they should do that every day for 7 days, it says in 24. Then in verses 26 to the end of the chapter, that is through 31, we have, you know, the daily sacrifices that were to be offered during the Feast of Weeks, as it's here called, which is, of course, Pentecost, so-called Feast of Weeks because it was marked 7 weeks after Passover and then the next day after the 7th week, which is the 50th day. And the name Pentecost comes from the word 50 days. And so we're talking about the Feast of Weeks is Pentecost. And basically the same as above. Each day the same offerings are to be offered as were for the Passover weeks. Then in chapter 29, verses 1 through 6 give these offerings to be offered at the Feast of Trumpets. And they are the same as above, except there's one less bull. Instead of 2 young bulls, 1 ram, 7 yearling lambs, and a goat, it's 1 young bull, 1 ram, 7 yearling lambs, and a goat. So it's basically the same offerings for the Feast of Trumpets as were offered every day of the Feast of Passover and the Feast of Weeks. One less bull, though, in that case. And then, in verses 7 through 11, on the Day of Atonement, in addition to the special things that had done on the Day of Atonement, there was this sacrifice to be offered, and it was the same as was offered on the Feast of Trumpets. And in other words, the same offered in verses 1 through 6. Basically, the same set of sacrifices, but one bull instead of 2 are offered. We can save a lot of time by saying that without reading it all. And then, there's a great deal of space given to the daily offerings of the Feast of Tabernacles. And unlike the Passover and Pentecost, where you offered the same sacrifice every day, at the Feast of Tabernacles, each day was a different sacrifice, but not very different. It followed a pattern. On the first day, verse 12 says, what one would offer was, as a burnt offering, 13 young bulls, 2 rams, and 14 yearling lambs, as well as a goat for a sin offering. And each day afterward, it was the same, except the number of bulls would be diminished by 1. Okay, so the first day, they'd offer 13 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 yearling lambs, and a goat for a sin offering. The second day, it's the same, but only 12 bulls instead of 13. That's in verse 17 through 19. In verses 20 through 22, it's the same again, only one less bull. Again, that's 11 bulls now. And in verses 23 through 25, on the fourth day of that week, they offer the same, only 10 bulls. It's diminishing the number of bulls each day by one. So on the fifth day, it's down to 9 bulls, verses 26 through 28. On the sixth day, verses 29 through 31, it's down to 8 bulls. And then on the seventh day, it's down to 7 bulls in verses 32 through 34. Now, that's not the end of it. It goes down to 7, but then on the eighth day, they do it all the same, except they reduce it to 1 bull. Once they've taken 13 down to 7, then they just offer 1 bull. They don't go down to 6, 5, 4, and so forth. They jump on the eighth day to 1 bull. Now, that seems like that should be significant. And maybe it is, but I don't know what it means. And one of the things that may cloud the issue is the fulfillment of this feast, as far as its spiritual meaning, is still somewhat obscure. The Passover has been fulfilled by Jesus at the dying on the Passover. He actually was our Passover, offered up actually on the day of Passover. And the spiritual fulfillment of Pentecost has been fulfilled also. And that happened, amazingly, on the day of Pentecost. When the Jews were celebrating Pentecost, God fulfilled it. But scholars are not agreed as to the exact fulfillment of the Feast of Tabernacles. And most seem to believe it has not yet been fulfilled. Whatever it symbolizes has not yet happened. It's fairly common among evangelicals to believe that the fulfillment of this feast is at the second coming of Christ. Some who believe in a millennium after the time of Christ might even apply it to its fulfillment during the millennium. But in either case, its fulfillment has not yet occurred, and because it hasn't, we can't be quite as clear on what it means as we can with some of these that have been. After something's been fulfilled, it's a lot clearer in retrospect than looking forward to it. Now, I'm not sure whether the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles has been fulfilled or not. I tend to go just with the standard view that it represents the second coming of Christ. There have been things that made me wonder whether I'm wrong about that and whether everyone else is wrong about that or not. But without having a better theory that I could defend, I'll just go with what's commonly said. The Feast of Tabernacles is the one of the feasts that has not been fulfilled yet and will be fulfilled at the second coming of Christ. That being so, there may be something about this reduction of bulls each by one day and then jumping down from 7 to 1. I mean, there's probably symbolism there, but it's awfully hard to know the meaning of the symbols before its fulfillment. Even after its fulfillment, we may not be able to explain everything, but except that we'll know then as also we are known. So I guess either we'll know or we won't care about why they reduced the number of bulls by each time it started out with 13. I mean, that's what's written. So let it be written, so let it be done. But it doesn't mean much to us, at least not to me. Maybe you got a revelation about that. Verse 39, these things you shall present to the Lord at your appointed feasts besides your vowed offerings and your freewill offerings, as your burnt offerings and your grain offerings, as your drink offerings and your peace offerings. So Moses told the children of Israel everything just as the Lord said to Moses. Now, mercifully, we have a short chapter here in chapter 30. And it's about the laws of take vows. Essentially, the law is this. If a person takes a vow, they have to keep it. They don't have to take it in the first place, but they have to keep it if they take it. Furthermore, the only person whose vow is binding is the head of the household or anyone in the household whose vow has been made known to the head of the household and not been disapproved. That is to say, if a wife makes a vow without her husband knowing it, it's not binding until her husband knows it and approves it. Now, he doesn't have to approve it verbally. He can just approve it by default. If he knows of it and doesn't disapprove it on the first day that he learns of it, then it's binding, and the woman has to keep her vow. If, on the other hand, her husband hears about it, and on the same day that he hears about it, he says, no, I don't agree with that. We're not going to give that cow, as my wife said we are. Got other plans for that cow. Well, then the Bible says here that she's free from her vow, and whatever guilt there is from breaking it falls on her husband. The Bible doesn't say whether her husband really has to suffer any guilt for it, but it does indicate that he takes responsibility because the head of the household. Now, the same is said to be true of a young girl still in her father's house. So if she either has a husband or a father, a woman in those days either had a father in whose house she was, or a husband in whose house she was. And in either case, her vow was not binding until or would not remain binding if her husband or father had not heard of it, or heard of it and disallowed it. But if the man of the house had heard of it and said nothing against it on the first day of his becoming aware of it, then it remained as firm as if a man had made it himself. Some of the things that I've wondered about this is what that would say about a case, for instance, where a young girl goes off and gets married to someone without her father's knowledge or permission. If in the sight of God, when he learns of it, if he says, "I don't approve of that vow she made," I wonder if in God's sight she should be made free from that marriage. Vows are very binding things, and of course marriage vows are the vows that we think of most often, because we don't make vows that often in our society. Sometimes people take vows when they're giving testimony in court. Of course, you take a vow then. And there are marriage vows, and there's only a very, very few other situations where vows are really used in our society. But according to God, if a wife or a daughter under her father's care, and this presumably would apply to a minor son as well. There's no reason to believe that it wouldn't apply to a son also who was not of age yet, that the man of the household, the head of the household, has the right to disavow the vow. Yes?
Is there any passages in the New Testament that
say that? I'm not sure. You know, of course, Jesus referred to the practice of vows in the Sermon on the Mount. But even what he said about it has been, I think, construed various ways. A lot of people feel that Jesus made the whole process of vowing sinful when he said, "Well, you've heard that you shall not swear, that if you swear an oath to the Lord, you must keep your oath. But I said, you swear not at all. Don't swear by heaven or by earth or by your own head," and so forth. And it sounds like he's saying vows are wrong altogether. But as I understand Jesus, he's not saying vows are wrong. He's saying that vows should be unnecessary for the believer. The believer should be honest enough that when he says yes, he keeps his word, whether vow about it or not. And whether he says, if he commits himself not to do something, if he says no, then he keeps his word, whether he has a vow or not. I think what Jesus is saying is you shouldn't require yourself to be put under oath in order to tell the truth. And the assumption was that men are basically dishonest, and vows were needed to keep them honest. That they would put the fear of God in them. If you swear by God, well, then I was going to be dishonest, but I guess I'll keep my word now because I don't want God mad at me. You know, I mean, it's obviously a strange way of looking at God, think that he'd be mad at you if you broke an oath, but not if you just broke your word. But oaths were a system for keeping people honest. And when Jesus said, "Don't vow at all," I don't think, for example, that Jesus is forbidding marriage vows or even taking an oath in court to tell the truth or whatever. If that is what is required in order to make it legal, Paul actually took vows. He swore by God. Jesus allowed himself to be put under oath in court when the high priest said, "I adjure you by the living God, tell me if you're the Christ." Well, that's putting him under oath. "I adjure you by the living God" is sort of like saying, "Swear by God." I mean, it's equivalent to that. Vows are found in the life of Jesus and of Paul and of me. Jesus was not making the taking of vows an immoral thing. It's just that it's immoral to be such a person that unless you've taken a vow, nothing keeps you honest. And he says, "Don't swear at all. Just say yes and mean yes, and say no and mean no." I don't think he's making vows somehow an immoral thing or a wrong thing to do. He's saying, why should you bother to vow? Why don't you just tell the truth? You know, I mean, why would you need an oath to keep honest? And I do believe that oaths have their place. That is when you're required to be put under oath. I don't think there's any sin in receiving that or taking an oath. I don't think Jesus' words really forbid it. It may sound like it on the surface. But as far as whether a father can make a decision about his daughter's marriage, whether the New Testament says anything about that, the only passage I can think of that even relates to a father's prerogative in the marriage of his daughter is a passage which is actually ambiguous. Some people think it's not talking about a father's prerogative. Some people think it's talking about the fiancé's prerogative. But in 1 Corinthians 7, it says in verse 36 through 38, "But if any man thinks he is behaving improperly toward his virgin," now his virgin could mean his virgin daughter. Some translations actually render it his virgin daughter. Or it could mean his virgin to whom he is engaged, his fiancée. It's unclear because it simply says his virgin. And therefore, it could be, you know, the guy whose virgin it is could be the girl's fiancé or her father. But anyway, it says, if anyone thinks he's behaving improperly toward his virgin, if she has passed the flower of her youth, and thus it must be, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin. Let them marry. Nevertheless, he who stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity but has power over his own will, and so determined in his heart that he will keep his virgin, does well. So then, he who gives her in marriage does well, but he who does not give her in marriage does better. Now, most of what Paul says there sounds like he's talking to the fiancé, because he's encouraging singleness if possible. He says, however, if you think you're not doing right by your virgin, meaning your fiancé, if you all of a sudden get real spiritual and decide to take a vow of celibacy, but you've been promised to this girl from childhood, and now, you know, if you take a vow of celibacy, where does that put her? She's betrothed to you. She can't marry someone else. That may not be fair. If you feel like you're not being fair, then go ahead and marry. No problem. You know, do right by her. But on the other hand, if you can keep her, that is, if you can support her and not marry her or something, if you can somehow do right by her and stay single, all the better. Now, that's how some people understand the passage, but especially verse 38 when it says, he who gives her in marriage does well, he who does not give her in marriage does better. It sounds almost like it's talking about the father, because the father would be the one who gives the daughter in marriage. So it's unclear whether Paul's talking to fathers or suitors or fiancés or betrothed ones. But certainly that last verse sounds like it's talking about fathers, and it talks about the father making the decision of whether he'll give his daughter or not to be married, whether he'll... that's, of course, until recent years, that was an assumption even in our modern society that a girl wouldn't marry someone that her father didn't approve of. I mean, even though it's a mere formality now in most marriages, it's a normal part of marriage ceremony. Who gives this woman to be married to this man? The question is not who gives this man to be married to the woman, because it's not assumed that the parents are giving away the husband, they're giving away the daughter. Who gives this woman to be married to this man? And the father typically says, her mother and I do. That's an old throwback to the ancient custom based on the Bible that, a man gave his daughter to be married or he didn't give her to be married. And I think that, therefore, it's possible that even marriage vows would be such that even if they've been consummated without the father's knowledge or approval, when he learns of it, he says, I don't approve of this marriage. I'm bringing my daughter home, you know. Now, I mean, that's a radical thing to suggest, especially in our society where people assume, well, what do parents will have it to do with anything? You know, I mean... To tell you the truth, I married the first time some of my parents didn't much like. They didn't forbid me to. But, you know, the society in the 70s was such that very many parents would even dare to say, don't marry someone. It was just assumed, you know, your parents don't have anything. It was you that's married or not them, you know. And it was a very rebellious decade. And I feel like I would have done far better had I waited for my parents to give me counsel or to approve. It turned out to be a bad marriage and a bad choice, and I think my parents would have probably discouraged it had I asked their counsel about it, but I didn't, and that was foolish. But nowadays, of course, it's just assumed. Well, a lot of people don't even know who your father is. You know, how could you hold out for a system where the father has to give her away? Who's my dad? I don't even know, you know. But that doesn't mean that Christians shouldn't seek to, it's among themselves, observe biblical principles about such things. And I think that we do see the principle in chapter 30 of Numbers of the father having the authority over the daughter and the wife's vows and able to just null them. It's like if the wife goes out without permission, charges a whole bunch of things on the charge card and comes home and the husband hears about it, he can go cancel all those charges. Yeah. Have to return the merchandise too, I'm afraid. But he gets to decide whether her commitments are kept or not. And, of course, this stems back from the assumption that the husband is the one who's the breadwinner. That's not an assumption in our society anymore, though it should be. But the assumption is that the man provides for his family. And whatever commitments his wife makes for their finances, because a vow usually had to do with, I'm going to give the firstborn of a cow to the Lord, or I'm going to give, you know, half of our sheep to the Lord or something. Well, I mean, a wife making that decision without her husband's permission is taking that, which is really his domain, you know, the family's real estate and the family's property and the family's possessions. And, in fact, even Hannah, you know, Hannah made a vow to give her son to the Lord. And her husband wasn't even there, but we learned that he heard of it and he approved. If he had not approved, then her vow would not have had to be kept. But obviously, in a society where the where the biblical ideals of marriage, where the man is in the role of Christ with the church and the woman is in the role of the church with Christ, then it would have to be that such decisions would have to stand the husband's approval, or else they couldn't be enforced. A woman shouldn't make such vows probably without the husband's approval, or she might, in those days, might just make them knowing that she'd have to tell the husband and get his approval for it, as Hannah, I'm sure, did. There's not much I need to read here because I've summarized everything that's in verse 30. Basically, it's in verse 2, if a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears with an oath and binds himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. There's very strong language along these lines in the book of Ecclesiastes about the need to keep your vows. And, vows are optional. You were never required to take a vow under the Jewish law, but once you took it, you were required to be honest and keep your word. It says in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, it says in verse 2, Ecclesiastes 5:2, do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. He's referring to vows, as becomes clear in the later context. Don't hastily make vows, like Jephthah did, and vowed to sacrifice anything that came out of his house after he came home victorious, turned out to be his daughter. Don't be rash with your mouth, and don't let your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, you're on earth, therefore let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. It is better not to vow than to vow and not to pay. It's better not to make promises at all than promise and then say, oh, sorry, God, I can't keep this one. Well, if you couldn't keep it, if you didn't know that you could keep it, you shouldn't have made it, because God expects you to honor what comes out of your mouth. Now, why would God care so much about something like that? I mean, sticks and stones can break people's bones, but words can't hurt anyone, can they? I mean, why would God hold a man so accountable for what he says out of his mouth? Because God intends for his people to be the reflection of himself, for his people's character to be his character exhibited before the observing world. And how many times have we met people who have rejected God, not based on any fault they ever found in God, but faults they found in God's people? People who won't go to church, people who won't even consider Christianity, not because God's ever done anything wrong, but because people that they associated with God did things wrong. God intends for his people to reflect his own character and natures and to show the excellency of his virtues in their own lives, so that people say, oh, if God's that way, that's a God worth serving. And that's the opposite of what often happens. But the one reason God requires and makes such a high premium on his people keeping their promises is, why do you suppose? Because God's a promise-keeping God, and he wants everyone to know that. If the people of God who profess to follow God's ways and imitate God don't keep their promises, how is the world ever going to become convinced that God is a faithful God who keeps his vows, keeps his promises? He is, and that's one of the more important things people need to know. And therefore, it's no light matter for God's people to break a vow or to break a promise or to, in any other way, show lack of integrity. It brings a blot on the way observers will think about God. Now, in chapter 31, we have the story of a war against the Midianites. This is sort of a follow-up to chapter 25. Apart from the sermons that Moses gives in Deuteronomy, this is the last official act of Moses before he dies, and that is to send the troops out against the Midianites. Now, this is, as I say, a follow-on to chapter 25, where through the counsel of Balaam, Midianite women and Moabite women, apparently, Moabites and Midianites combined, hatched this plot. They seduced some of the men of Israel. In chapter 25, verse 1, it says it was women of Moab. But in this chapter, it refers to the Midianites. And when the women are brought home alive, Moses in chapter 31, verse 16, says these are the women who caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord. So we've got Midianite and Moabite women both involved. Now, this is not a contradiction. Just because chapter 25 says Moabites and chapter 31 says Midianites. The fact is that we read earlier in chapter 22, I think it is, that Balak, the son of the king of Moab, consulted with the Midianites, and they conspired together to hire Balaam and so forth. So the Midianites and the Moabites were together in this deal. And apparently they both supplied women into the plot to seduce and lead into apostasy the Jews. So God actually tells Moses to send the people out against the Midianites to wipe them out. Now this wipeout was not to be quite so total as later the wipeout of the Canaanites, which was to kill everything that breathed. And also later on when Saul sent out against the Amalekites, he was not supposed to leave anything alive. That was not required here, but they were supposed to thoroughly judge them. And this was going to require about 12,000 troops. And they took 1,000 from each tribe. It says in verse 2, "Take vengeance on the children, for the children of Israel, on the Midianites. Afterward you shall be gathered to your people." God said that to Moses. Verse 3, "So Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm some of yourselves for the war." Verse 4 says, 1,000 from each tribe. And it goes into this in some detail. Then it says they went to war, 1,000 from each tribe. In verse 7, "And they warred against the Midianites," verse 7, "just as the Lord commanded Moses, and they killed all the males." That would be the adult males, apparently, from what follows. "And they killed the kings of Midian with the rest of those who were killed, namely Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, 5 kings of Midian. Balaam, the son of Beor, they also killed with the sword." So Balaam came to his end at this time. "And the children of Israel took all the women of Midian captive with their little ones." So they couldn't bring themselves, apparently, to kill the little babies and the women. We're not told why they didn't kill them. Maybe they just thought it would be too brutal to kill women and children. But Moses, in this case, told them that they were too soft-hearted and that they needed to be a little more severe, because it was these women who had a direct participation in the seduction of the Israelites that had brought a curse that had killed 24,000 Israelites. Some light matter. And it says in verse 14, "Moses was angry with the officers of the army, with the captains over thousands, captains over hundreds who had come from the battle. And Moses said to them, have you kept all the women alive? Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor, and there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. Now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man intimately. But keep alive for yourselves all the young girls who have not known a man intimately." Now, a lot of people have cynically made reference to this and said, oh, you know, Moses lets them keep all the young girls for love slaves. There's nothing mentioned here about love slaves. There's nothing said about here of having sex with these girls. They are kept, and in the absence of any information to the contrary, we must assume as servant girls. Both males and females in times of ancient wars were taken captive and made servants of. It is true, some people might have married their servants or even abused their servants, but that's not an assumption here. The assumption is not that you're supposed to keep all the girls for yourself in the sense that some lewd perverts would think of that, and frankly, the people who criticize the Bible on this point obviously show their own perversion, because the Bible doesn't insinuate any such thing. And if that's what they read in there, that's because it's in their own corrupt heart, what they would do if given these instructions. Keep these girls for yourself. Well, Moses doesn't say they're kept for any lewd or immoral purposes. The reason they are spared, ones who are virgins, is because they clearly were not involved in the Peor incident. The ones who were involved in the Peor incident had sexual intercourse with men. That was what they did wrong. Now, of course, not every woman who was not a virgin would necessarily have been involved in that, but one could not know for sure which had and which had not. Therefore, just all the ones that were clearly not innocent, I mean, let's put it this way, all the ones that were clearly innocent, the virgins, who clearly could be shown to have not had any sexual intercourse, they obviously were not involved in the incident. Therefore, they'd be spared because they were clearly innocent. The women who could not be demonstrated to be innocent in this way were just assumed guilty or at least dangerous, and they were dispatched. Now, the hardest thing about this is where it says to kill the little ones among the males. And I cannot tell you why, in this case, God required this. I can give you some suggestions. It's always hard when we read of God's instructions to the Jews to wipe out men, women, children, everyone, as he did to said about the Amalekites and the Canaanites and so forth. And we think, why those poor little children? Well, there's another option. He could just leave them alive without parents. these little infants, and then they could die a slow and torturous death of starvation. It may seem a rather brutal thing to kill children. In fact, it is. I would never want to do it. I don't see how I could do that. I mean, if God commanded it in those days, I guess I'd have no choice but to obey God. But I'd find it, almost unthinkable, of course. However, obeying God is, let's put it this way, disobeying God should be unthinkable. If God says this is the right thing to do, then it's the right thing to do. After all, where do we get our notions of right and wrong? Do we make them up? Do they come out of our own sentiments? Or does it come from God's character and God's commands? As I understand it, and this will not settle well with everybody, but this is what I understand to be the case, I believe that infants who die go to heaven. And infants who don't die grow up and sometimes go to hell. And therefore, one who dies in infancy, at least seen one way, in the eternal scheme of things, I think is somewhat better off than a lot of them that don't die in infancy, who grow up and end up burning in hell. You might say, well, the chance to live. Well, what's more important? A chance to live for 70 years on this planet, burn in hell forever? Or a chance to die at a young age and live in heaven forever? Now, this may sound like, a pie in the sky, so heavenly minded, no earthly good kind of a caricature that people often think of Christians. Well, who cares if everyone dies or going to heaven? Well, let's face it. Paul said, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. And if the same is true of infants, if infants are in fact saved, now this is disputed. Many people don't believe this, but I believe that can be established scripturally. Then to die, in a sense, is gain for them too. That doesn't mean that we should go around killing all infants any more than it means we should go around killing all Christians. The time of a person's death, even if to die is gain, it still must be left in the hands of God. It's not for us to go around and kill every Christian because, well, they're ready to go, or kill all babies because they're ready to go. When I tell people I think that babies that are aborted go to be with the Lord, some people who don't think very clearly say, then why oppose abortion then? Well, for obvious reasons. It's murder, Just because someone is murdered, just because the murder victim goes to heaven doesn't mean that the murder was not a crime or an abomination to God. If you would walk up and shoot me in the head, I'd go to heaven. But that doesn't mean that your act wasn't an atrocity. Just because someone goes to heaven doesn't mean that their murder was not a great crime and a great sin. And, of course, we oppose abortion, though those who have this kind of theology, some don't, perhaps, believe that those victims, fortunately, go to be with the Lord. But that doesn't make it any less a crime, what was perpetrated against them. Sam, you had a comment or a question. You mean only the males and not the females? Or do you mean why didn't it all societies?
In
general. You mean like in the wars of the Jews, why didn't he always have them exterminate everybody? And I mean, is that what you're thinking?
No, I was just thinking you think that God's reason why that is more merciful than these young boys to be killed at a young age and later when they've grown up to be wicked.
Well, let me clarify. I don't think that was God's reason. I think that's a consideration involved in our assessment of the goodness or evil of of what God said. And obviously, I don't even entertain for a moment the possibility that what God said is evil. But sometimes we wonder why it isn't, And one consideration, maybe, this doesn't mean it's God's reasoning for commanding it, but one consideration is the atrocity of it is mitigated somewhat when you consider that those infants who died in such a circumstance would go to be with the Lord. But as far as God's reason for it, it may have been simply that God didn't want Israel to be strapped with a whole bunch of orphans to take care of, foreign orphans, and that these children were now going to be parentless because both their mothers and their fathers were killed in battle. And rather than leaving them out for the jackals, at least to tear them apart alive, to dispatch the children rather than have the Jews adopt them all and have this huge number of Midianite boys grow up among them, apparently was not deemed profitable. Now, take girls as servants, another thing. And perhaps one of the reasons the girls would be spared, not the guys, is because in that society, and most societies, women are not as dominant as males, and as adults, the women would tend to conform to whatever the religion and practices of their husbands would be, whereas males, growing up, might be more of an influence toward paganism. In fact, it's not inconceivable that they might even be demon-possessed, a great number of them. I mean, societies that worshipped idols, Paul said they worshipped demons. And Moses said that too in Deuteronomy. And I personally believe no, this cannot be established beyond question, but I think there are hints of it both in missionary histories as well as some perhaps allusions in the Bible that might be relevant to the subject. Now, I think that infants born to demon-possessed parents can sometimes be born afflicted in this way with demon possession and need deliverance. And so there may be any number of factors that God does not communicate here that if we knew, we might say, oh, I understand now why God commanded that. Since God does not communicate his reasons, I only put these things out as speculations, and maybe none of them are his reason. But I do not rest easy with just this kind of a command without knowing, you know, well, why would God think this way? Why would God give an order like this? I mean, if I can't figure it out, then God's entitled to make a decision I don't understand. But if I can understand it, I try to. And those are some of the factors that enter into my thinking. Yes, Rob? I don't think there's anything in the Bible that says that to be possessed by a demon, you have to somehow be willing to open up to it. I think that if a person is willing to open up to a demon, they are more in danger of being possessed than one who does not. But we have, for example, the case of a boy that was possessed from childhood, if not infancy, in the Gospels. The man who brought his son to Jesus' disciples, and they couldn't cast the demon out, and the Transfiguration cast the demon out. We presume this is a boy or a young man. And Jesus asked the father, how long has he been in this condition? He said, since childhood. Now, I don't know how an infant or a child can do anything so evil that it would be worthy of or tantamount to opening oneself up to demon possession. I am of the opinion, and I've thought a great deal about this and searched the scriptures without much fruit being yielded as answering the question of how do people get demon possessed in the first place. There are many theories about it. We don't have time to really go into all of them right now, but the Bible simply does not tell us how people become demon-possessed. But it does seem clear that not all unbelievers are demon-possessed, and there must be something that differentiates between the ones who are and the ones who are not. I mean, why don't the demons just fill everybody up who's not a Christian, since they don't have Christ protecting them? And I suspect, from the data that I'm able to sort out in Scripture, as well as in missions history, biographies, which I've read a great deal, I have one book that contains 30 different testimonies from different missionaries around the world in their demon experiences dealing with demon-possessed people. And from these, a certain amount of information can be gleaned, although since it's not in Scripture, you've got to take some of it with a grain of salt. But these are evangelical missionaries and telling what they've experienced in the mission field. The data that I've collected, which has been for about... I've had a very concentrated interest in this subject for 25 years. And the most frustrating thing is how little data there is on this to answer these questions in the Bible. But I think that a person becomes demon-possessed when they are vulnerable, when they're weak, when they're malleable, when they're easily controlled by other persons than themselves. The Bible says, he that has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls. And a city broken down without walls in the Scripture time would be a city that's subject to invasion without being able to resist invasion. Now, I don't know that that's distinctly about demon possession, but to say that if a man has no rule over his own spirit, he is subject to being invaded by hostile forces. He has like a city without defending walls. He can easily overrun. It may give a clue how some people become demonized, that they, if they do not maintain the rule over their own spirit. Now, some persons, even non-Christians, have more self-control than others. And I suspect people with a strong will and not easily persuaded, if not easily controlled by others, probably are not easily invaded by demons either, unless they do something specific to demon in. Other people, however, have a very different temperament. They just do whatever they're told to do. They're just very compliant, and they seem to have no backbone. They seem to have no resistance to anyone else's will. You know, anyone who makes a suggestion or looks at them angry, you know, they quickly are intimidated and do what they're told. I mean, there's definitely different kinds of personalities. And I suspect, I only say this as a suspicion, this is not biblical doctrine, that us who are most easily controlled by other people and who have no rule over their own spirit are probably the same people who are most easily controlled by demons, which are also alien personalities that seek to control people. And I don't know that a baby is more or less vulnerable than an adult. But I let me put it this way, Rob. Although what you say makes sense, that, you know, a person shouldn't be able to be demon-possessed unless they do something to open themselves up to it, That makes sense to me, too. The only problem is it doesn't ever say that in Scripture. It nowhere says in Scripture that you won't become demon-possessed unless you open yourself up and ask for it, you know. The fact of the matter is the Bible just treats demon possession as a given. It nowhere explains how people get demon-possessed, what specifically they did to come into that condition. And we do have at least one case in Scripture given of a child that was demon-possessed. How long that child had been, whether he was born that way or came into that condition at infancy or as a toddler or whatever, we don't know. But it's clear that a child can be demon-possessed. And the theory among most who have looked into it is that probably deep involvement in the occult is one of those things that most invites demonic invasion. I mean, when people look to the demonic powers to give them power, and when someone opens themselves up to input from the demonic realm, sometimes the demons input more than they're bargaining for, you know. And it is generally, you know, kind of common consensus among those who have an opinion about it, usually that involvement in the occult makes a person more vulnerable to demon possession than not being involved in the occult does. And so since all of these pagans had occultic religions, I mean, a lot of them offered their children as sacrifices to demons and everything in their worship of Moloch, Baal. We don't know. These societies have been gone a long time. We don't have any modern sociologists or anthropologists going to check them out and see, you know, how much demon possession exists among these people. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was rampant. You know, perhaps by giving all these suggestions, I'm actually giving the wrong impression, namely that God has to be justified in what he says to do. You know, if I say, well, maybe God said it for this reason or said it for that reason, I might convey the wrong notion. The wrong notion being that somehow God has to give an answer for his decisions, which he does not. I mean, obviously, God, who is a loving God and a just God, will never make a decision that is not loving and just. He cannot act against his own nature. It's just not always easy for us to see how that decision conforms to his generosity and his goodness and so forth. So I'm suggesting some possible ways that it could be looked at. But whether these explanations carry any water with you or not doesn't make any difference. I mean, God is justified in all that he does, and he's not in a position to have to justify himself to us. It's just that some of these things go against our grain, and it helps a little bit if we can see a little bit from God's perspective why he might have seen this as an okay thing to do, you know. Anyway, we need to move along real fast because we've taken a long detour here. Oh, that's all right. It's up to you. Okay, and then afterwards, in verse 19, he told all the soldiers, after killed all their prey, all their slain, to purify themselves in the normal way. They'd come near dead bodies, so they were unclean for 7 days. So they had to purify themselves on the third day and on the seventh day. We read instructions about that earlier. It says it specifically here in verse 19. Then as far as the booty, you know, the stuff they took. Once the Midianites were all dead, what do you do with all their stuff? Well, most of it you burn or get rid of in some way or another. However, he says in verse 22, only the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that endures the fire, you should put through the fire, and it should be clean, and it should be purified with water of purification. But all that cannot endure the fire, you should put through water. And you shall wash your clothes on the seventh day and be clean. This is to purify yourself and the stuff you took. Those things that could endure fire were passed through fire. When I said the rest was burned, I was only assuming. It doesn't say they were burned. But they may be. They were put through water and then perhaps burned after that, or maybe just put it through water was enough to cleanse it. It's not all that clear. Now, verses 25 to the end of the chapter mostly is about how they were to divide the booty up that made it. The people, the livestock, the gold, the silver, the stuff that they brought after it was purified, it was divided up between the priests and the Levites. About half of the booty was given to the soldiers, and the other half of the booty went to the people who were not soldiers. Now, the soldiers, of course, were the minority, so they got a bigger portion per man. There were only 12,000 soldiers, but there were, you know, 600,000 Israelites. So the soldiers got per capita a larger bit of the booty, and that seems only right. They stuck their necks out and endangered their lives in the process of getting it. But half the booty was given to the soldiers and half was given to the rest. Now, of the soldiers' booty, they had to give 1/500th of it to the priests. It says in verse 27, and divide the plunder into two parts between those who took part in the war, who went out to battle, and the congregation. And levy a tribute for the Lord on the men of war who went out to battle, one of every 500 of the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, and the sheep. Take it from their half and give it to Eleazar the priest as a heave offering to the Lord. And then the other half, which was given to the children of Israel, you take from their half one of every 50 persons or animals and give those, it says at the end of verse 30, to the Levites who keep charge of the tabernacle of the Lord. So the Levites and the priests got their share out of it, out of the booty as well. Verse 32 says, then the booty remaining from the plunder which the men of war had taken was 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, and 32,000 persons in all of the women who had not known a man intimately. So there were actually 32,000 virgin girls. That was a pretty large population of people they wiped out. There must have been, we must assume, something like 30,000, so it must have been about at least 120,000 or 150,000 people in all likelihood in that nation they conquered. Now, it sounds like they eliminated all the Midianites, but later on Midianites gave them trouble. In the days of Gideon, the Midianites were so numerous that they came and they overran Israel and kept them oppressed for a while. So we are to understand, I think, that the Midianites here was just one group of them that had been participants along with Moab in the seduction of the Israelites at Baal Peor. There are other ethnic Midianites who lived in other regions, some of whom gave trouble to Israel later on. Same thing is true of the Amalekites. When Saul went out in the 15th chapter of 1 Samuel and wiped out all the Amalekites, well, you'd think, well, there'd be no more Amalekites, but there were more Amalekites later on. But apparently these are ethnic designations, but all the persons of that ethnicity didn't all live in the same place. They were nomadic, you know, Arab-type peoples who moved around, and so they smote one group of them, the ones who had been involved with Moab in seducing the Israelites. Okay. They took after this was all over, verse 49 says, and they said to Moses, your servants have taken count of the men of war who are under our command, and not a man of us is missing. So here's an unusual war. They go wipe out probably over 100,000 people, and not one Jew is dead. Not one Jew killed in battle. I mean, this is really unusual. When they conquered Canaan, although they won their battles, they often lost soldiers, some soldiers. But here, not one man among the Jews was killed. Imagine all those arrows flying, all those swords swinging, spears going through the air. Not one of them hits a Jew. And, you know, over 100,000 in all likelihood, Midianites are wiped out without one casualty among the Jews. And so they realized that was divine protection, and they said, therefore, verse 50, we have brought an offering for the Lord, what every man found of ornaments of gold, armlets, and bracelets, and signet rings, and earrings, and necklaces to make an atonement for ourselves before the Lord. So Moses, now, to make an atonement doesn't mean that they had committed some sin necessarily in going to war, since God had told them to go, but simply that all people need atonement. All people are sinners, and all people need to, have some way of making it right before the Lord. Now, we think of atonement always requiring blood. And it says in the New Testament, without the shedding of blood, there's no remission of sins. But along with blood sacrifices, there were other things that were related to atonement. I mean, other gifts were offered as well. Now, without blood, you can't have the remission of sins. But when there is blood, that doesn't mean other things, too, don't need to be offered. I mean, we don't offer animal sacrifices because the blood of Jesus atones for us. But that doesn't prevent us from having to offer up spiritual sacrifices as well, which do not really secure our salvation, but they're part of our priestly ministry. It says in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 15 that we're to offer up the fruit of our lips. In 1 Peter 2:5 it says we're to offer up spiritual sacrifices. In Romans 12:1 it says we're to present our bodies a living sacrifice to the Lord. So even though the blood offering has been offered by Christ, we still offer additional things, not for our salvation, but just as part of our relationship with God. It's part of our service to God. And these people, too, they did consider it part of their atonement. And I'm not sure to what extent that was appropriate thinking, but they offered this booty partly as the atonement for their sins. So Moses and Eleazar the priest received the gold from them, verse 51, and all fashioned ornaments. And all the gold of the offerings that they offered to the Lord from the captains of thousands, captains of hundreds, was 16,750 shekels, I assume that's a lot. And the men of war had taken spoil, every man for himself. And Moses and Eleazar the priest received the gold from the captains of thousands and so forth. And they received it as a memorial for the children of Israel before the Lord. Now, chapter 32, we're gonna kind of summarize. It is information that comes up again in Deuteronomy. I think more than once in Deuteronomy it comes up. And that is the settling of the land to the west of the Jordan, which was called Gilead. That land that was taken from King Og and King Sihon and so forth in those battles that Israel already had fought without having entered the land. This land to the west of the Jordan, it's called, we would call it Transjordania for obvious reasons. Trans is across and Jordania, across the Jordan. Technically, this land was not part of the promised land that God had offered to Abram and his offspring. But there were certain tribes, especially Gad and Reuben, who had apparently more livestock than the other tribes did, and they noticed that this region was particularly good for grazing. And so they came to Moses and said, would it be all right if we just settled here? I mean, we've already conquered this land. It is okay if we just have this as our inheritance and you don't give us an inheritance in the land. Now, Moses' initial reaction to this request was very negative. He thought they were trying to get out of, the responsibility of warring, further wars in Canaan. And he thought that their request would discourage other Israelites and make them want to just stay where they were too. And we read Moses' response to them in verse 6. Moses said to the children of Gad and the children of Reuben, shall your brethren go to war while you sit here? Now why will you discourage the heart of the children of Israel from going out over into the land which the Lord has given them? Thus your fathers did when I sent them away from Kadesh Barnea. And he goes on to tell about how the spies who had discouraged the people from going into the land. And he said, I don't want a repeat of that. He basically says that what you're doing, verse 14, look, you have risen in your father's place. In other words, you're doing what your fathers did. Your fathers are now dead, and you're rising up to fill their role as discouragers of the people. It says, verse 14, look, you've risen in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to increase more the fierce anger of the Lord against Israel. For if you turn away from following him, he will once again leave them in the wilderness, and you will destroy all these people. Now, Moses may have jumped to conclusions too quickly, because it sounds like the people of Gad and Reuben were not really interested in taking the easy way out. Or maybe Moses, by his comments, made them kind of modify what they originally wanted to do. But they agreed then that they would go over and fight the wars, but they still would like to inherit this land over here for their flocks. It says in verse 16, they came near to him and said, we will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our little ones, but we ourselves will be armed, ready to go before the children of Israel until we have fought, we have brought them into their place. And he says, they say in verse 18, we will not return to our homes until every one of the children of Israel has received his inheritance. Well, this took several years for them to conquer the land, about 6 years, I believe. And so this really involved them in being separated from their families and their possessions for several years. There was an upside and downside to this. On the one hand, it was good grazing land. On the other hand, it was very poorly defended. It was without natural defenses. The promised land on the other side of the Jordan had the Mediterranean on one side and the Jordan as the other boundary, and it was much harder to invade because there was the natural protection of the river there. I mean, it could still be invaded from the north or the south, but it was much more easily defended because of the river. Now, these people on the western side of the river didn't have these natural defenses, so they were much more susceptible to being overrun, and often were. Eastern side of the river, sorry. The western side of the river is the promised land. The eastern side is where these people were, right? Thank you. And so on one hand, they're getting good grazing land, but the downside is they're getting land that's not so easily defended. Another thing is that they were, a good upside of their request was that their children and wives would not be subject to the dangers of going into the land. I mean, the rest of the tribes are going to go in there and fight wars with their families with them. And whereas these guys were going to leave their wives and children in safety over here, and they're going to go over and fight knowing their wives and children were safe. On the other hand, though, they had to be away from their wives and children for several years in doing so. And so there's sort of a balance of both the advantage and the disadvantages of what they were suggesting. And once they put it that way, that they would go over and fight and help the rest of the tribes win their land, but then they'd come back over here and inherit this land, that was amenable to Moses. It says, verse 20, then Moses said to them, if you do this thing, if you offer yourselves before the Lord for the war, and all your armed men cross over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven out your enemies from before him, and the land is subdued before the Lord, then afterward you may return and be blameless before the Lord and before Israel, and this land shall be your possession. But if you do not do so, then take note, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Now, perhaps this stern threat is there because Moses would not be around to enforce this. If he could, see, if he approved this plan, they always, you know, say, well, Moses approved of this, but if they never came back, you know, if they never did what they said they'd do, if they left the battle early and went back to their land while the others were still conquering the land, this would be after Moses was dead. And Moses is saying, listen, I'm not going to be there to enforce this, but no, your sin will find you out. If you agree to this and don't keep it, then obviously you've sinned against the Lord, and he knows your number. He knows where to find you, and he'll find you. Okay, so it says in verse 28, so Moses gave command concerning them to Eleazar the priest and to Joshua the son of Nun, who would be leading the people into the land, the leaders, and Moses gave them orders that these men would have it. Now in verse 33, the half-tribe or half of the tribe of Manasseh is added to the names of Gad and Reuben as the tribes that will be inheriting this region of Gilead. We are told up to verse 33 only about Gad and Reuben having an interest in the land, but for some reason Moses includes half of the tribe of Manasseh. So I guess we are to assume that when Reuben and Gad approached Moses, probably some representatives from Manasseh were there too, but because it wasn't the whole tribe, they weren't mentioned earlier. But now he specifies, verse 33, Moses gave the children of Gad, the children of Reuben, and the half, and to half the tribe of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, the kingdom of Sion, king of the Amorites, and the king of Og, the king of Bashan, the land of its cities within its borders and its cities surrounding the country. And the children of Gad built, then it gives names of cities that they built. And it says in verse 39, the children of Maker, the son of Manasseh, went to Gilead and took it, and dispossessed the Amorites who were in it. So Moses gave Gilead, which is that region to the east of the Jordan, to Maker, the son of Manasseh, and he dwelt in it, of course, and the other tribes too that were mentioned. So we have the agreement made here. There are repeated references to it in Deuteronomy and in Joshua. This comes up again, but here's where we first read of that agreement being made. Now, chapter 33 is sort of a summary of all the encampments that the Israelites encamped in during the whole 40 years. I think about 24 of the places that are in this chapter are also found in Exodus. There are altogether, I think, 42 place names in this chapter. About 42. About 24 of which are also mentioned in the Exodus account, and only about a dozen of the places can be identified today. So the vast majority, about 30 of them, are names that we don't know where they are today. They're lost. They're ancient sites. They were probably just oases in their own day, or villages, or whatever. I mean, they were not major cities. They were just locations that the name meant something back then, but we don't know where they are now. About a dozen of the places can be identified today. It'll do us no great good to read all the places, but we can read the opening verses. Verse chapter 33, these are the journeys of the children of Israel who went out of the land of Egypt by their armies, under the hand of Moses and Aaron. Now Moses wrote down the starting points of their journeys. And it goes back to when they first left Egypt. In verse 3, they departed from Rameses, which is where they started, in the first month, on the 15th day of the month, on the day after the Passover. And it talks about in verse 4, they went out boldly, because verse 4 says the Egyptians were still burying all their firstborn, so they weren't there to resist them leaving, whom the Lord had killed among them. Then it goes in verse 5 and talks about they went from Rameses to Succoth, and from there, verse 6 says to Etham, then verse 7 to Pi-Hahiroth. And also in verse 7, they came to Migdal. Verse 8 says they departed from before Hahiroth and passed through the midst of the sea, that the Red Sea, of course, into the wilderness. They went 3 days' journey into the wilderness of Etham and camped at Marah. Of course, that's where the bitter waters were that Moses changed into sweet waters. Then they came to Elim, which Exodus also mentioned in chapter 16 or 17, somewhere around there, or 15, it was 15, excuse me. And there were 70 palm trees there. We're told that in Exodus and here. Then they moved from Elim and camped by the Red Sea. And then we have other place names numbered, given. We don't need to read them all. They are, as I say, most of them unidentifiable today, but it's a basic catalog of all the places where the cloud moved them to and then stopped and they encamped. And we were told earlier that the cloud sometimes would move, you know, after only 2 days of having been in one place, or a month or a year. Apparently, sometimes they camped as long as a year in a location. Maybe that was more common than not. So that in 40 years, they camped in 42 places. Sometimes they may have been more than a year in one place. We know they were a little over a year at Sinai. So anyway, that's what we got here. We have this catalog of places that they went. In verses 50 through 56, Moses tells them how to divide up the land when they get into Canaan. He tells them they're going to go in and they're going to wipe out the inhabitants of the land. In verse 54, he says, "And you shall divide the land by lot as an inheritance among your families." Now, remember in the Bible, the lot, which is what we would consider a matter of chance, like rolling dice or you know, drawing straws or something like that. This was not considered to be just a matter of chance. God controls the lot. You may recall that the apostles in Acts chapter 1 actually used the drawing of lots as a means to choose an apostle to replace Judas. This is no small decision. And yet they trusted God that he would work through what would ordinarily be regarded as a chance kind of a occurrence. But they figured there's no such thing as chance. God's in this. Proverbs apparently agrees with this. In Proverbs 16:33 says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." So you may cast lots and have the appearance of letting chance take its course, but in fact its decision comes from the Lord. It was knowing the will of God. So the land was divided among the different families of Israel by casting lots to decide which lot God would give to each family. And God warns them to wipe out all the Canaanites. In verse 55, he says, "But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall be that those whom you let remain shall be irritants or smoke in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall harass you in the land wherever you dwell. Moreover, it shall be that I will do to you as I thought to do to them." So God said, if you don't wipe out the Canaanites, what's going to happen is they're going to corrupt you. And when you become corrupted, I'll be as hard on you as I was going to be on them. And God says this in other ways, in other places too, throughout the Pentateuch, that if the Israelites would repeat the crime of the Canaanites and adopt their ways for themselves, God would treat them just as badly as he treated the Canaanites. The Israelites did not have some unconditional favor with God, some unconditional land grant. It was all based upon the fact that he gave them special privilege, which if they would use it, they could have special continuing privilege, if they would obey what God said. When it says that these Canaanites, if you don't drive them out, will be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your side, some people have thought that this reference to thorns in the side possibly helps to understand what Paul meant in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 when he spoke about having a thorn in his flesh. When Paul talked about how God had given him a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan, to buffet him and to keep him humble from his great revelations, most Christians understand this to be a reference to some illness or something in Paul, but some say no, a thorn in the flesh here in Numbers, a thorn in the side, is a reference not to a sickness but to opponents, to, in this case, Canaanites who would remain alive if the Jews didn't kill them all and would give them trouble. And so Paul, when he talks about the thorn in his flesh, they say, is talking about some illness or whatever in him, but is referring to some person, some irritant, some opponent, who is like a messenger from Satan. Well, Paul had such opponents, and it may well be that that is what he meant. Although I incline toward the other view, simply because there are other scriptures, and even some verses in that passage, that seem to incline toward the view he was talking about a physical infirmity. But some feel, by cross-referencing with this verse, we can say that the term thorn in the flesh resembles very closely thorns in your sides, and in this case it referred to humans, not sickness. Chapter 34, he talks about the boundaries of the land of the Canaan. He doesn't talk about the boundaries of each tribe here. That was going to be determined by lot later, by the casting lots. But he gives the general macro boundaries of the land. In verse 3, he tells where the southern border will be, along the wilderness of Zin, along the border of Edom. This would be down to the south and east or west of the Salt Sea, or the what we call the Dead Sea today. And the western border is mentioned in verse 6. which is, of course, the Great Sea. It calls it the Great Sea. That's what we call the Mediterranean, was the western border of the land. And then verse 7 has the northern border from the Mediterranean across, moving east over to Mount Hor, and other places are mentioned, many of them hard to identify today. And then the eastern border is given in verse 10. You shall mark out your eastern border from Hazar Enan, and give some other place names. It mentions how that the eastern border shall, in 11, go down and reach to the eastern side of the Sea of Chinnereth. This Sea of Chinnereth obviously must be the Sea of Galilee, because from there it goes down along the Jordan. Now, the Jordan basically runs from the Sea of Galilee south into the Dead Sea. And it mentions the Sea of Chinnereth going down along the Jordan to the Salt Sea, which is what we call the Dead Sea. So he's given here the traditional boundaries that we know are of Israel. You can check any map in the back of your book and see where those places are. But he mentions in verse 15 that the two and a half tribes, Gad, Reuben, and half of Manasseh, would receive their inheritance on the other side of the Jordan, not within these boundaries. In verses 16 to the end of chapter 34, it mentions the leaders who would be appointed to govern the distribution of land once they were in there, and to sort of oversee and administrate the distribution, the casting of lots. There was one from each tribe. Verse 16 says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, these are the names of the men who shall divide the land among you as an inheritance, Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun. And you shall take one leader of each tribe to divide the land for the inheritance." So apparently Joshua and Eleazar would give the general, this block goes to the tribe of so-and-so, and this goes to the tribe of so-and-so, but these leaders in the tribes would subdivide it among the families and clans. And it gives names, none of which are important enough for us to pay attention to, except, of course, in verse 19, of the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, whom we're already familiar with, was the leader of his tribe. The other tribal leaders are not known to us. Now, chapter 35, rather lengthy in number of verses, but I can easily summarize what it's about. In verses 1 through 8, it says that since the Levites received no land grant, they didn't receive any body of land in the land of Canaan like the other tribes did, because the Lord is their inheritance. They received, however, they had to live somewhere, they received cities. Altogether, the Levites received 48 different cities to be theirs, and these were distributed throughout the land of all the other tribes. So the Levites actually were distributed among the other tribes, and they had Levitical cities, as they were called. Six of these cities were to be cities of refuge, and the description of the cities of refuge is given from verse 9 on. And there's a fair bit of detail given about that, but it's real easy to say what the cities of refuge are about. The cities of refuge were places where a person who was accidentally became guilty of manslaughter, but was not a deliberate murderer, he could flee. Here's the basic backdrop for this. If a person committed murder, he was worthy of death. And in those days, the executioner was to be the next of kin to the deceased. So if your brother was murdered, you would be the avenger of blood. Or if it was your son, the nearest relative would be the one referred to as the avenger of blood. We read of that in verse 19. The avenger of blood himself shall put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. If a person commits murder, the next of kin was the avenger of blood, and he'd go and find him and kill him. Now, this would be true even if the murder was accidental, unless the accidental killer was able to flee successfully to one of these cities of refuge. There were three on the west and three on the east side of the Jordan River, so that whether a person lived on either side of the Jordan, he could still get to one. And in the cities of refuge, there would be courts, apparently, and magistrates. And if a man fled that city, and he came there and said, "Listen, I accidentally killed the guy. I was throwing a rock, and I didn't know he was there. And he walked in front of me, and the rock hit him in the head and killed him. And now the Avenger of Blood's after me." They would give him a fair trial, and maybe the Avenger of Blood would show up at the city later, and they'd actually have a trial, and evidence would be brought, and so forth. And it's made very clear that a person cannot be condemned unless there's two witnesses against him. A person cannot be condemned on the testimony of one witness, as that in verse 30. Whoever kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the testimony of witnesses, but one witness is not sufficient testimony against a person for the death penalty. If the man who claimed it that the murder was accidental is found guilty, he was thrown out of the city of refuge and he was allowed to be killed by the avenger of blood. If he was innocent, however, he was allowed to stay in the city of refuge, and he had to stay there either until his own death or until the death of the high priest, which is an interesting rule here. It says there in verse 25, "So the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood, and the congregation shall return him to the city of refuge where he had fled, and he shall remain there until the death of the high priest who is anointed with the holy oil." Now, if the person would leave the city of refuge before the death of the high priest, then the avenger of blood, he was fair game. He could be killed by the avenger of blood. But if he stayed in the city of refuge, he was immune until the high priest died, and then he could leave and he'd be immune. Now, strange law. In a sense, a man who was guilty of manslaughter, though accidental, he did not receive capital punishment, but he did receive life in prison, at least either his life or the high priest. And there may be some hint here, some type of Christ, our high priest. We are sinners. We are worthy of death. But if we flee to the refuge that God has provided for us, you know, there is safety there. God has provided a refuge for the sinner from the avenger of blood, from the death penalty for our sins. And to add to the figure, the person is, as it were, a prisoner in the city of refuge until his own death, which frees him, or the death of the high priest, which frees him. And Jesus, according to Hebrews, is our great high priest, and in a sense, his death has freed us. We're not spending life in prison or receiving the death penalty from God. We are set free by the death of our great high priest. And therefore, though we have committed crimes worthy of death, we have been set free by the death of Jesus. And we are not vulnerable to the avenger who has the power of death, which is the devil, according to Hebrews 2:15 or 2:14. The devil is he who had the power of death, but we've been delivered from him by the death of Jesus, it says in Hebrews 2:14. Now, the last chapter in Numbers, for which we have about 4.5 minutes to cover, fortunately is a short one. You'll remember that earlier on, some women, sisters, who had no brothers, but whose father had died in the wilderness, were concerned. In chapter 27, these were the daughters of Zelophehad. They said, "Our father had no son to pass on his inheritance to. Therefore, it seems that we, the daughters, should get the inheritance." And God said to Moses, "That's right, they should." And so a law was made that if a man had no sons when he died, his inheritance would go to his daughters. If he had no daughters, he'd go to his brother. If he had no brother, he'd go to his father's brothers. If he, you know, remember that one? Okay, well, this is sort of the follow-on to that. It was not the daughters who came to Moses' time, but others of their kin, of the same tribe, which was the tribe of Maker, one half of the Manasseh tribe. These daughters were of Manasseh. And these guys say, "Now, wait a minute. You have said that these daughters can inherit their father's land, but suppose they marry someone of another tribe. If they marry someone of another tribe, then that land goes into the power and to the possession of the husband of these women, and therefore it changes tribes." And God did not want, and these people did not want, for tribal lands to change from one family to the next. The lands were supposed to be perpetually in the same tribe. So the complaint here and the concern was these women, now they've inherited their dad's property in the territory of Manasseh. But suppose these women are someone from, say, the tribe of Judah or the tribe of Issachar or something, and their offspring then inherit it, and they are officially of the tribe of Issachar or of Judah or whatever tribe the father was. So the land that used to belong to Manasseh now belongs to this other tribe. And they didn't want that happening. They thought they might lose too much land that way. So God is consulted about this. And it says in verse 5, "Moses called the children of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying, what the tribe of the sons of Joseph speaks is right. This is what the Lord commands concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, let them marry whom they think best, but they may marry only within the family of their father's tribe." So though these women could marry anyone they wanted, it had to be within the tribe of their father. They couldn't marry outside the tribe, lest it would endanger the inheritance rights and the perpetuity of the land and the tribal boundaries. Sounds very much like Paul said to widows, says they can marry anyone they want to, but only in the Lord. There's freedom and there's restriction. Being a follower of Christ or being obedient to God has a great deal of flexibility and a great deal of freedom, but there's also restriction, even in such personal things as who you marry. You can marry anyone you want as long as it's in the Lord, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7 in the closing verses. Here, the women, you know, maybe they'd fall in love with someone from the tribe of Judah. That's tough. They have to marry someone in their tribe. Now, however, within their tribe, they had thousands of males to choose from, but they had to marry within their tribe. So it was made a law that when a daughter inherited her father's property, she had to marry someone in her same tribe so that her children who would inherit the property would be the tribe of her father and the inheritance would stay with it. And with this law, basically, the book of Numbers closes. Which is kind of not very climactic, not very exciting. But no one ever said the book of Numbers was supposed to be exciting. There are some interesting things in it. But that brings us to the end of it. A lot of these things come up again. I think the daughters of Zelophehad come up again in Deuteronomy. And also, in Joshua. So some of this stuff you'll hear of again. But some of it comes up for the first time in Numbers. And we've just made a very rapid dash through the book, did not give complete treatment to everything that we might otherwise have, but we already took more time than was allotted, so we'll call that the end of our treatment.